This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. The new documentary, The Interrupters, is about former Chicago gang leaders who are working with current gang members to break the cycle of retaliatory gang violence. The Violence Interrupters are part of a larger anti-gang violence program in Chicago called Ceasefire. The Interrupters break up fights as they're happening, mediate, call for truces, or simply try to talk someone out of violent retaliation. Earlier this week, I spoke with the film's director, Steve James, and one of the interrupters that the film follows, Amina Matthews. James also directed Hoop Dreams. His film, The Interrupters, was inspired by a New York Times Magazine article written by Alex Kotlowitz, who produced the film with James. Amina Matthews used to be the enforcer in a gang and has a lot of street credibility. Her father, Jeff Fort, led one of Chicago's most notorious gangs, the Blackstone Raiders, which he expanded into a street cartel that united many individual gangs in the 1960s. He's now in prison for drug trafficking and conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism. Let's start with a scene from The Interrupters. It takes place at a roundtable meeting of the Violence Interrupters. We'll hear a couple of cutaways to T.O. Hardiman, the director of Ceasefire Illinois, who originated and piloted the Violence Interrupters project.
Everybody that's in the meeting, this is serious now, okay?
We're in a crisis mode, and we need people to step up this table and go over and beyond.
Guys are getting killed for just anything.
Have there been any conflicts mediated on the front end from last week to this week?
Two guys was arguing. One guy threatened to blow the other guy's wig back. I got him to calm down, tell him he didn't shoot you, he was just talking. We stopped that one on the front end.
This kid was out in a pretty crazy neighborhood. Some guys passed by in a car, they said something, he jumped out in the middle of the street, confronted these guys. The guy went behind him with a baseball bat, hit him in his legs, dropped him to his knees, and then cracked his head open. Our understanding is he wants to back away.
I have the Dirty Dozen at the table. We've always had outreach workers, but the violence was not necessarily going down at that point. So in the year 2004, we began a new concept called the Violence Interrupters. Most of the Violence Interrupters come from the hierarchy in some of these gangs, because can't know anybody come in and tell a guy to put his gun down.
People at this table used to shoot at each other, used to try to go at each other, for real. Serious enemies.
For real.
I ain't been around these many vice lords since I was on F House job.
To stop a killing, you have to be able to intercept whispers.
Kind of soft, they kept calling me. Man, they shooting. I said, what you want me to do? Just ask me what you want me to do.
The Violence Interrupters had one goal in mind, to stop killings. They're not trying to dismantle gangs. What they're trying to do is save a life.
It's a scene from The Interrupters. Steve James, Amina Matthews, welcome to Fresh Air. Steve, why did you want to make a film about the Violence Interrupters?
Well, it really started with my colleague, Alex Kotlowitz, who wrote an article in the New York Times Magazine that focused on Ceasefire. And Alex and I have been friends for years looking to do something together. And when I read the article, I called him up and I said, I think this is the thing we should do. And I think for both of us, we've seen violence in the city be so persistent and seem to paralyze the city in some ways. And even personally, Alex in his book, There Are No Children Here, he saw three people he knew in the course of writing that book perish on the streets. And for me, two people from Hoop Dreams, Arthur Agee, one of the kids we followed, his dad was murdered back in 2004. And William Gates, the other kid we followed in that film, his older brother Curtis was murdered in 2001.
Now, Amina is one of the people you focus on in the film, one of the interrupters you focus on. Why did you choose her? The answer is obvious to anyone who's seen the film, but for those of our listeners who haven't.
Well, when we went to Ceasefire after Alex's article and approached them about doing a film, we wanted to meet with several interrupters, and Alex knew a bunch of them. I mean, Amina immediately jumped out. She's one of only two women interrupters around the table. And she's this, as you noted, if you've seen the film, she's this incredibly charismatic person. You know, she walks into a room and your eyes go to her. And I think the other thing was is that we knew that she was the daughter of Jeff Fort, who is, you know, one of the most notorious gang leaders in the history of Chicago crime. And, you know, all of that just made us think we've got to have Amina in this film.
Well, let's hear a scene with Amina in it. And this scene starts with Amina describing the story of a boy who was shot on his front porch. And then we hear her at a street prayer vigil for him, trying to talk his friends and family out of violently avenging his death.
Our mosque is holding a prayer vigil for a kid shot sitting in front of his home just listening to the radio. Corey definitely wasn't in a gang, and he was loved by his block. When rage sets in, when ego sets in, when a Hennessy sets in,
I'm gonna walk down here to where Corey's friends are. You stay right here.
These young guys say, let's go get who we think did it. I'm hearing 20 different things why that brother got changed. And all of it is stupid. All of it is stupid. 2 o'clock in the afternoon when these babies coming home from school, y'all shoot. For real. This is unacceptable for me to be holding this boy, this young man's obituary. Schools, churches, your mama's house, your cars, those are safe zones. When I was about your age, I was making some real stupid decisions and some stupid calls that was causing me, my life, blood on my hands and my head. Stop. Who does this baby belong to? Who does this little shorty belong to? He just hanging around, y'all? He just hanging around, y'all, right? So he see everything that you all do, right? So if this brother right here catch a case and do 100 years, whose fault is it? It's his fault?
Our fault.
Teach him righteous.
That's Amina Matthews in a scene from the new documentary, The Interrupters. Amina, did that particular story end with violent retribution, or were you able to help prevent that from happening?
Yeah, we stopped the retaliation. It was done at that point. And Corey wasn't shot on his porch. He was shot in the car in front of his house with his mother in the car speaking with him. So that's really how his life ended.
Amina, have you've seen a lot of funerals, both from the times when you were in the life and now as an interrupter working with young people trying to prevent violence. Has the tone of funerals changed from when you were young to now when you're attending the funerals of a lot of young people?
Absolutely. Death is inevitable, and we're not afraid of it. And what's so profound to me is that in that casket, I'm looking at 13, 14, 15, 18, 19-year-old men and women dying on the streets of Chicago. And that's what's so profound to me about the violence. People look at it and they say, well, oh, Chicago has always been violent, but Chicago has not had the youth violence and the youth death as high as it's been for the last several years. So that is the most profound impact that has struck my nerve and my heart and my soul, you know, and it's just heart-wrenching to me.
How did you become a violence interrupter?
It was a mediation that needed to be handled. It was at Leo High School. Leo High School is in the Auburn Gresham area of Chicago. And this young man and a couple of guys got into a fight in the school. And one of the young guys got his shoes stolen, and he went home and he told his brother, and his brother wanted to go back and, you know, defend him. And the mother called Ceasefire and got in touch with Tio, and Tio got in touch with James Highsmith, which is one of the guys that taught me the game back in my heyday of my life. And he had called and asked me, could I help him with a situation that could turn deadly? And I did. And I didn't know the young man, and I got in the car and grabbed some few guys because I didn't know what the temperament of this young man was, and we drove down on where we thought this young man would be, and I asked him to get in the van, and he ran from me, and then he started calling people and asking, who is this lady in a scarf looking for him? And then I actually sat down with him and talked to him and weighed his options, and He promised that he was going to stand down, and we got the other side. James was handling the other side, and we got them to stand down, and that was a mediation that was stopped. Really, we consider that a front end. It was a, you know, little boys fighting, that it didn't end up in gunplay.
And had you ever done anything like that?
Have I ever done anything like that before? I got kids, Terry, so you know. It's, you know, yes and no. I didn't know exactly the weight that it held, but, you know, in the street and you're on the block and you're trying to hustle and you got a, you know, a mob that you're dealing with and you want to keep peace. You don't want the police to come. You don't want, you know, drama on your block. Or, yeah, if it's some, you know, if it's some beefing going on, you get right in the middle of it and you resolve it and then you keep it moving.
So the concept of the violence interrupters is that these are people who have been not only gang members, but often in the leadership of the gangs, because that will give them more credibility on the street when dealing with other gang members. So do the people, do you find that a useful premise or a useful working premise? Does that work? Do you have more credibility when you're trying to mediate, when you're trying to prevent, you know, retribution because you were in the game?
Yes. In the population that we're dealing with, you know, you have to have some type of background. The first thing that they'll say, if you come on the block and you haven't lived or walked the walk, how can you tell me anything? You don't know how I live. You don't know how I breathe. You don't know nothing. And 9 times out of 10, with these little young guys and girls that I encounter, they know my father maybe 45%, but they knew different things about what I did 75-85%, because it was a household name with maybe their aunt or their uncle or their grandfather or their father. Even with my old man, once I get in, I'll mention, you know, or they'll ask me, because of course they'll go and pull my file. Pulling file is making phone calls, writing down on people and saying, is this person, this person, is this person? And, you know, and when they come back or if I ride back around, the way that they look is like, oh my goodness, what did I do to have this person come and speak to me? And, you know, it is. It's a door opener.
So what's one of the things in your file that is most impressive?
I don't have the file in front of me right now, so I just can't. you know, of course, you know that I'm a girl, and I ran with the big dogs. I ran with the guys that the known brothers in the street. And when I say known, I mean known brothers in the street. And it had nothing to do with my old man. Known brothers of the street. And with every interaction that they made, I was right there beside them, or if not in front of them, leading the charge. And so I didn't back down from, I would really die for what I believed in back there, same way as now. And I understand that how these kids feel, that they're out on the street and it's like Afghanistan to them. And if one of their brothers or sisters die out there, it's like a fallen soldier over there and across the waters. They feel that this is something that is honorable and that I served well.
And in the movie, you describe this gang as having dealt with drugs, stick-ups, pimping. Did you have an Amina in your life? Did you have anybody like yourself to tell you violence isn't a good thing? Mm. Anyone in your family, an outsider, anyone?
Well, you know, not an outsider. You know, it's history is just so profound. And me being a parent and looking back at a lot of things that I used to say that I never was going to do, and I look back and with my kids, I think I've said maybe about 1,000,000 times the exact words that Madea have said to me.
This is your mother?
With my children. It's my grandmother. That's who raised me. So looking at her, she just looked like, to me, that's Madea. What does she know? She's a lady that get up and go to work, had three jobs sometimes. We lived in a roach-infested apartment. What does she know? I'm going to make her life better, and she's going to see. But things that she was really telling me and nuggets that she was dropping on me as I was growing up, it was really law. It was really the truth. She was, you know, got a heart of a gunfighter. I mean, Madea would step in the middle of raids asking, where is Amina? You know, guns is drawn, you know, and she's not even looking at the guns, not even looking at the gas that was thrown in the building to smoke us out. She's yelling my name and telling me to get my behind out and let's go home and I'm not coming back again. And she was there, you know, but an outsider, nah.
You're talking about how your grandmother laid down the law. And there's times mm-hmm. when you do that. We see an example of that in the film, and I'd like to play that scene. Through the film, you're working with a 19-year-old young woman named Capricia, and she has no parents. And you've been working with her thinking that you're really kind of making headway and getting her to believe in herself and to believe that she can make changes and believe that she can be loved and that she could lead a more, just a better life. And then there's this really discouraging moment where you find out that she's kind of lied to you about school. So in the first part of this scene, you're describing what happened. In the second part, we hear you and her sitting on a park bench and talking. And this is a scene from the new documentary, The Interrupters.
She was saying that tomorrow's the first day of school, and I'm so excited. And I was excited for her. She's going with a fresh hairdo. I went today and found out school started 3 weeks ago.
I did go to school.
You went to school when you got the ready to. You didn't go up there when it was time for them to go.
Actually,
in.
Actually, yes, I did. Miss Mina, you don't know that. You don't know that.
Capricia, your counselor said you got there when you got there.
And I got there at 8:55 before everybody.
Capricia.
Right.
You didn't fight hard enough for you to get up in that school and do what you need to do.
I ain't got
to
say nothing.
Capricia, don't nobody have to kiss your ass for you to do what you need to do for you.
And I'm still going to be the same person at the end of the day.
At the end of the day doing what?
Getting my life together takes time.
Time for what? You did 2 years out of your life. Wasn't that enough time for you to get your life together? What you do is you manipulate, you do this and you do that, and then you're so ashamed and afraid that when I ask you to be honest with me, you can't. Do you want to be loved? Absolutely. Do you deserve to be loved?
No.
Nope. Absolutely.
Nope.
First thing, you got to love you.
All I can say is, wow, Amina, that's really amazing, the work that you're doing with her there and how hard you're trying to reach Capricia. I should mention what we've just heard is a scene from the new documentary, The Interrupters. My guests are Amina Matthews, who we just heard in that scene talking to the young woman, Capricia, and Steve James, who is the director of the film. He also directed the now famous documentary, Hoop Dreams, about young basketball players. So, Amina, you were just talking about how your grandmother really laid down the law and was really tough with you. How did you know that this was time to really kind of get tough with her? We see so many different sides of you in this film. There's times when you're just so warm and loving and supportive, and times like this when it's time to just really get tough.
Well, you know, time is valuable, and it's not promised to us. And I just look at Capricia as, you know, only for the grace of God there once I was. So with someone like Capricia, you can't, baby, can you please, when you feel like it, get up and go to school? And can you please, baby, not go back to jail? And can you, you can't, because then she'll manipulate that circumstance and situation. But once you let me in and you let me know that you want what I have to offer, then I feel like, look, this is what you need to do for you. Especially after I'm putting in my time, my money, leaving my children and my family for her, and she's out there struggling. So, you know, that scene just, I guess, came from the heart, man. It
it's something that needed to have been addressed with her and still continuously to be addressed with her, because if it doesn't, it's going to be fatal for her.
I mean, did it affect your work at all or your comfort level to know that you were being filmed during interactions like the one we just heard with Capricia?
No, I don't think so. Because at the time where when Steve and Alex and Zach was on location, it was business that needed to be tend to, you know, and that was something that I needed not to worry about is these cameras. And, you know, they were not on my back, you know.
Really?
Telling me to move over so I can get this shot. You know, they got what they needed from their space and not in our space.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
In that scene with Capricia, at one point, Capricia says to Amina, well, it's easy for you to open up. And Amina says, no, I don't just open up to anybody. And the thing that was interesting about that is that Amina was telling the absolute truth, because it took us a long time to get Amina to a place where I think she was fully open with us. I mean, she gave us access to her mediations, and she gave us an initial terrific interview. But there was a point earlier in the process where I think she did see us as maybe like the other media, and she was really wondering, like, what is it that these guys really want?
The issue, and Steve knows this, is that I fought so hard to get to where I am today. And to what I do in the streets, it's personable and it's personal. But they wanted the storytelling about who Amina is inside and out of being a violence interrupter. It's like looking at the brain of an interrupter's. And I have children, and, you know, and some people don't look at my life far as my dad being who he is and far as my journey and where I've come a nice thing. And it was hard for me to let that guard down and let them in so they can understand, so people can understand that here it is, someone that has come from the south side of Chicago, that has been raised under bricks, and, you know, flower has grown from up under the bricks. So I was really just reluctant to let them in, because I know people don't love my dad like I love my dad. And I'm very protective of my family because I've lost my brother to the streets, you know, and I had to identify his body in Riff River. And it was because of people that loved, said that they loved him, killed him. So it was kind of, you know, I know Steve, he doesn't look and he doesn't feel like a mean, malicious person and want to get the best next thing. And Alex showed that through black and white in the paper. I let them into my world and I put myself at a vulnerable state for people to judge. And so that's why the reluctancy was there.
I think the key word that you just said is vulnerable. That's like the last thing that you're allowed to show when you're doing work on the street is vulnerability. I mean, what everybody says is if you show a vulnerable part of yourself, that's what people will take advantage of and exploit.
Right.
So
right.
I can understand why that was really hard to show any vulnerability in a public way. You know, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about watching the movie is how sometimes, like, something that's seen as the slightest sign of disrespect will set somebody off and it'll lead to violence. And you say something very interesting about that. You mentioned that when you were young and your father was in prison and your mother's boyfriend sexually abused you, you were just really on a short fuse. So after a situation like that, if someone just knocked into you and didn't apologize, you'd flip immediately into rage.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really interesting explanation for how what's could be seen as a really like minor infringement or minor sign of disrespect can be met with such a kind of violent, hostile reaction.
Right.
Does sharing stories like that help people consider their own reactions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's like a profound issue in our community, may it be African American or white. I mean, you know, these girls are violated, even the guys are. And it's, you know, taboo to talk about, and you're not feeling good. And, you know, just understanding what they're going through, because I went through it, you know, been there, done that. And has it, I have the T-shirt, the coffee mug, and, you know, all of that. And I understand their mindset of why they would react and go from zero to rage in 30 seconds. You know, I understand that. So, yeah, but that did play a part in my history.
You are Muslim and your husband is the...
Big Daddy.
Yeah.
He is the Big Daddy.
Yeah, he's the head of the mosque that you belong to. And I'm thinking that you wear a headscarf when you're on the street.
All the time. Got on one now.
I'm thinking that must be actually very valuable in its own way, because what it's saying, you dress very modestly, and what it's saying to the young men who you work with on the street is like, you are not there as an object of, you know, you're not there as a sexual object in any way. And you're not presenting yourself as like a sexual object in any way. And they are not to see you that way. And you're also kind of implicitly sending the message to the young women, you're not there to compete with them sexually. You're not there to compete about who's better looking or who's got the better clothes. You are there to help them. And that's it.
I need you to have that typed up and email that to me so I can present that to them as I'm introducing myself. Yes, that's exactly it. Very good put together. People, I didn't think about that, Steve. I just, you know, get up and get dressed, Terry. I didn't, you
know. Steve, your film is filled with interesting people like Amina and some amazing stories. Are there things that you learned by making this film that you really didn't understand before?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, because I don't obviously live in Inglewood or those communities that we're following, documenting in the film, I think I had this sense that people were numb to the violence in those communities because it's so pervasive, and that they've maybe even given up. Because that's the sense you get when you read the articles day after day in the paper of the violence. And I think one of the things that was remarkable about this experience of making this film was number one, seeing they're not numb at all. They may not be surprised when they lose a loved one, but they're devastated, and you see that. And people haven't given up hope, despite the fact that the economy's where it's at, all the vacant lots and foreclosed homes and lack of jobs. People still have some hope, tenuous though it may be.
Steve James directed the new documentary, The Interrupters. Amina Matthews is one of the violence interrupters featured in the film. The Violence Interrupters Project is part of the group Ceasefire Illinois. You'll find a longer version of my conversation with Steve James and Amina Matthews on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, actor Andy Serkis, has appeared in more than 30 films, but you wouldn't recognize him in some of his most celebrated roles. When he played King Kong in the 2005 remake and the tormented creature Gollum in the Lord of the Rings series, he appeared not as himself, but as a computer-generated image. Those roles involved a technique known as performance capture, in which an actor performs in a skin-tight suit with special markers allowing cameras to capture his body movements and facial expressions. Computer graphic images are then imposed on the movements to transform the actor into a 25-foot ape or some other creature on film. Serkis stars in a performance capture role in the new film The Rise of the Planet of the Apes with James Franco and John Lithgow. Serkis plays a chimp named Caesar. As part of a pharmaceutical experiment, he gets a drug that makes him super smart. The chimp is raised in a scientist's home. He's eventually sent to an animal refuge where he organizes an ape rebellion. Andy Serkis spoke to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies earlier this week.
Well, Andy Serkis, welcome to Fresh Air. In this film, you take a leading role with no dialogue, and you play the ape as an infant, right?
I play Caesar all the way from a toddlerhood all the way through to this, highly developed male who leads the revolution.
What you see with this character, Caesar, is he grows up as a human kid and then at some point realizes that he isn't. There's a moment when he goes outside. They have to take him on a leash and he suddenly realizes, wait a minute, I'm a kid, but they've got me around with a leash like a dog. You want to talk a little bit about sort of some of the emotions you see Caesar going through there and how you got to them and portrayed them?
Yeah, it's a really significant moment in the piece where Caesar begins to have this growing self-awareness. And the scene that happens after the one that you're describing really is the pivotal moment where, you know, he gets led back and he has this encounter with the dog and he then feels around his neck and realizes he has this choker around his neck. And when he's taken back to the car and he's being taken home and normally he gets into the trunk of the car, he stops and he looks at Will and he freezes, and this something in him realizes this is no longer right, and he moves over and gets into the passenger seat of the car. And it's a really significant silent moment of filmmaking, which was completely improvised and in the moment. So I was just living through that moment as an actor and believing this is what was right and felt right for that moment.
You, of course, you have this role, and you also played King Kong in the 2005 remake there, where you had to, in effect, express this emotional relationship between a 25-foot ape and Naomi Watts. And you're known for very rigorous preparation for your roles. And I'm wondering kind of what it does to your head to be in the mentality of an ape for weeks or months at a time.
I mean, certainly physically, it takes its toll. After Kong, my knuckles have never really recovered, because I had to wear every single day I had to wear very, very heavy weights on my forearms and around my hips and around my ankles to get the sense of size and scale of the movement of the character. And you know, Kong as a character is a very, very obviously a completely different a challenge. He's a lonely, very desperately lonely. Only kind of psychotic hobo, basically, who is past his prime. He's like a boxer who's taken that many hits. He every day is about survival, and the only beings he comes into contact with are ones that are trying to kill him and take him down. He knows he's the last of his species, and so when he actually is confronted with this other warm and non-threatening being, that he begins to feel a set of emotions that he probably hasn't ever felt since childhood. And from then this relationship develops, and he begins to and really the key turning point for Kong was a realization that he had a sense of humor, because he begins to enjoy her. There's a scene where Naomi Watts, which she played brilliantly, performs. Basically, she's performing to save her life, and Kong finds it amusing, and it's something that he's never encountered before. So that was another very challenging physical and emotionally connective role. It does leave you, it does, there's always a decompression period after playing any role that I get into, because I take it very seriously. And emotionally, you're tricking your mind and body into these situations. You know, you are telling your body that you are this thing and that you're feeling these thoughts and that you are experiencing these experiences. So it does always take time to kind of to come out the other end.
Well, we have to talk about Gollum, your portrayal of the creature in the Lord of the Rings films. This is really an amazing effect. And since not everyone's seen it and it's been a few years, why don't you just, first of all, describe Gollum physically and remind us of sort of how he became the creature he was in the story?
Gollum used to be a hobbit called Smeagol, and he was one of a clan that lived by a river. And he comes across the ring via his cousin, who discovers it when they're fishing one day, and he falls into the river and trying to catch a big fish. And Deagle, his cousin, comes across this shining object at the bottom of a lake and brings it up. And the moment that Smeagol, who is kind of known as a bit of a sneak in his village, I mean, he's not like a really terrible villain or anything, but he's a bit sneaky. And he then, immediately he lays eyes on it, becomes craven and lustful towards it and cannot take his eyes off it, and to the point where he fights his cousin and kills him and throttles him. He then, over a number of years, is kind of cast out into the wilderness and begins to physically, mentally depreciate and become riddled and scarred mentally and physically, and curl and twist and get knotted up as if this virulent kind of physical disease was overtaking him. And it's the effect of the ring and the craven lustfulness of the ring overpowering him. And he turns into Gollum, and he can't bear to be in view of the sunlight. It almost exposes him to the guilt of him killing his cousin. And he crawls into the middle of what's an area known as the Misty Mountains and hides himself underground for nearly 500 years and gradually turns mad. And he begins to talk to himself, and the two sides of his personality are at war with each other. This Smeagol, the innocent sort of side of himself, and Gollum, the more aggressive, manipulative.
Now let's listen to the voice. This is a scene from the second Lord of the Rings film, and here Gollum is, the two sides of his personality are arguing with one another. They're obsessed with the ring that is, of course, at the center of the story, which he refers to as precious, and he's here arguing with his darker self about whether to turn against Frodo Baggins, who he refers to as his master. Let's listen.
Yes, precious, false. They will cheat you, hurt you, lie. Master's my friend. You don't have any friends. Nobody likes you.
Not listening. Not listening.
You're a liar. And a thief.
No.
Murderer.
Go away.
Go away.
And that's our guest Andy Serkis playing Gollum in The Lord of the Rings. Tell us about getting the voice. Is your voice enhanced in any way, or is that just you?
No, that's just my voice.
Wow.
And I'm not like a voice actor per se. I don't just do voices. It only comes through character and through acting, and for me it's linked entirely to physicality and through centering an emotion around a voice. So Gollum, as I described earlier, he feels very guilty about murdering his cousin, and a lot of his guilt is trapped in his throat. And he's called Gollum. Tolkien calls him Gollum because of the way he sounds. So I had to find a voice that sounded like someone Gollum-ing. This the ring is overpowering him, and I wanted this sense that his body was controlled by it. So there was an involuntary action that was making him sound like this. And I looked to one of my cats, actually, Diz, who sadly isn't around anymore, but he came in while I was kind of working on the character one day and coughed up a fur ball. And this became really interesting to me because you watch a cat throwing up a fur ball, and it's like the whole body sort of writhes from the tip of the neck to the tip of the tail and sort of convulses, and you see this ripple going down its spine, and then this sound kind of happens where it kind of comes into the throat, and you see this fur about to being chucked up, and then they sort of go, which suddenly became, and that's how the sound happened.
Oh my heavens! It must have been fun living with you while you were getting that right.
Absolutely.
Well, Andy Serkis, I wish we had more time. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Andy Serkis stars in the new film Rise of the Planet of the Apes with the help of computer graphics. You can hear more of his conversation with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies on our website, freshair.npr.org. Chris Collingwood and Adam Schlesinger, the duo behind Fountains of Wayne, just released their first new album since 2007. Skyfall of Holes showcases the detailed storytelling and bright melodies that rock critic Ken Tucker says can occasionally hide darker thoughts.
She's been afraid of the Cuisinart since 1977. Now when she opens up the house, well, she won't set foot in the kitchen. Her brother's dating an architect. They're coming up for the weekend. He never gave her the proper respect, but she still needs the fairy to greet them.
There's a dreamy summer breeze wafting through much of Sky Full of Holes, as though Fountains of Wayne wanted to make the new album sync up with the season. And just as this summer has been hotter than many recent ones, there's also a warm intensity to some of the songs, such as the album's first single, Someone's Gonna Break Your Heart. The 13 songs on Sky Full of Holes are pretty consistent pleasures in the manner we've come to expect from Fountains of Wayne. Precisely worded, catchy songs about small moments in life that can be breezy and witty, as well as breezy, witty, and poignant. Their biggest hit, 2003's Stacy's Mom, a winking foray into broad humor, holds the same place in Fountains of Wayne's career as Dead Skunk does in Loudon Wainwright III's, or as Short People did in Randy Newman's. A fluke for which there's no reason to try and replicate, and thus the musicians went back to their more clever business. Like this song, Richie and Reuben, about a couple of on-the-make entrepreneurs who aren't nearly as smart as they think they are.
They opened up a bar called Living Hell. Right from the start it didn't go too well. They didn't have the vibe or quite the right clientele. They bought a velvet rope and the doorman laughed. They got robbed blind by half the waitstaff. 6 short weeks and they were forced to sell. Richie and Reuben don't know what they're doing. Richie and Reuben are both a little out of their minds. Don't give them a dime.
You could say that Richie and Reuben is Fountain of Wayne's Steely Dan song, cynical about subjects that merit cynicism, presenting a narrator who thinks he's tough-minded but might be one of the suckers that Richie and Reuben have scammed in the past. One of the prettiest songs on the album is A Road Song, about a guy in a rock band on tour who's missing his loved one so much he's writing her a song. Its beauty is enhanced by the precision of its meter and rhyme.
We're still in Wisconsin, as far as I know. Today was Green Bay and tomorrow Chicago. Wish I was lying, but there isn't much to report. My phone is dying, so I've got to keep it short. I just wanted to say, I've been writing you a road song. It's a cliche, but hey, that doesn't make it so wrong. And in between the stops at the Cracker Barrel and 40 movies with Will Ferrell, I need some way to occupy my time. So I'm writing you a road song.
At one point in that song, Fountains of Wayne sings, "I bought you a light blue t-shirt last night from some band I couldn't stand, but their logo's all right." That couplet is wry and sweet, and I admire the little internal rhyme of light and night in the first line. But what clinches its fineness is the way it captures something that happens in everyday life but is rarely noted. People do make purchases such as a souvenir t-shirt just because it looks good. It's not exactly an ironic buy, but it's close. More overt is the wistful sarcasm a bit later, when the narrator describes his road song by singing, "I know it's not what you'd call necessary, and I know that I'm no Steve Perry." For Fountains of Wayne fans, Journey is definitely an irony inducer. Fountains of Wayne is loath to make music cast as grand tragedy or melodrama, but at least a couple of times here, Collingwood and Schlesinger capture a mood of quiet despair in the songs Action Hero, about a hapless suburban dad, and this song, Hate to See You Like This, in which the narrator tries to cajole a young woman out of her listless depression. Fountains of Wayne is without doubt the finest contemporary pop rock band in America. And that and 99 Cents will get you a Lady Gaga download. Collingwood and Schlesinger occasionally pursue separate projects. Collingwood, who likes country music, reportedly has a solo album in the works, while Schlesinger has continued his interest in Broadway by co-writing the opening song on this past year's Tony Awards, It's Not Just for Gays Anymore, performed by host Neil Patrick Harris. And jolly good for them, as long as it means the twosome will continue to regroup for more refreshed Fountains of Wayne-ness.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Sky Full of Holes from Fountains of Wayne.
If you've seen a show, then you already know